We bring the House Transportation Committee to order. President, Representative Dugan, Representative Book, and a few guests and testifiers. This is going to be pretty informal, obviously, today. We don't have enough to take any action or do anything like that. It's all informational. If anybody has cell phones or anything, if you could make sure they're turned off just so we don't get interrupted when we start talking about stuff. I'd like Representative Book to have the floor to talk about this meeting that was called while I was up here in Anchorage, and he can be more specific on what we're going to be doing today.
Sure. Today, the first speaker will be Frank McQuarrie. He's going to outline context-sensitive systems, and we're going to be talking about community road development, especially collector and feeder streets, some of the ideology, the codes, and the infrastructure development of urban road systems have come under very serious scrutiny here in Anchorage of late, and we're looking to incorporate some of the designs that have been promoted nationally in promoting especially our community road development. So what we're going to do here today is basically open the floor for discussion. We're going to have hopefully one presentation by Frank that will last about 20, 25 minutes. We're going to open this up. Jennifer, if you'd like to speak for about the same time, there will be enough time for this hour and a half meeting, we feel, or any other further discussion or any other online commentary. Certainly, if the presenters wish, they can set up their format, whether they'd rather have discussion at the end of their presentation or during. So with that, I'm going to introduce Frank McQuarrie. And Frank, you have the floor.
Thank you, Bob. For those of you who don't know me, I'll give you a little bit of background. I am not an engineer, and I'm not a highway designer. I am the president of the Anchorage Road Coalition. My background is actually intersects with roads in multiple levels. I was in banking here in Anchorage for a number of years. I've also run a trucking company, and I worked my way through school as a grade checker on road construction projects. And my father was a highway construction engineer, so there's a certain genetic affiliation with the process. And certainly as a user, both in the commercial sense and trucking, and as an individual, a high degree of interest. The Anchorage Road Coalition was formed primarily out of dissatisfaction with a number of projects that had been designed and built here in Anchorage on the level of the collector streets, which are both access and mobility streets, but should have a high degree of emphasis on access and safe access, whether it's for school children or people going to and from work and getting to their home neighborhoods. And a group of us became involved first with the Strawberry Road issues and then with projects we discovered all around town. And as we started researching, we discovered that there was a sea change going on in the profession in terms of philosophy of design, particularly with urban streets. Now, we're statewide, we're talking a lot more than urban streets, but as we got into looking at what the profession was trying to do with a process called CSS, we realized that it applied, would not only help solve problems, not solve them, but help solve some of the problems we saw with what was happening in Anchorage, but it also would have a great deal of applicability with some of our rural projects as well. I am going to show about 12 minutes of a slideshow that was done by the president of AASHTO. His term, I think, was in 2005. His name was Jack Lettier. And he speaks, obviously, from sort of the pinnacle of the profession. As the president of the American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials, has been the sort of the lead agency and professional organization, wrote the Green Book, the driving force between designing and managing and constructing the interstate highway systems. And Jack probably speaks with more credibility than I do. So I think the first few minutes of this slideshow will be very informative and hopefully useful for this committee.
Hello. My name is Jack Letier, President of the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials and Secretary of the New Jersey Department of Transportation. Welcome to this video, Context-Sensitive Solutions for the Transportation Professional. The transportation strategies for the next 50 years are going to be very different than the conventional strategies from the last 50 years. This video is intended to help transportation professionals adjust to the new transportation paradigm of context-sensitive solutions and to introduce the subject to others as well. Since the 1950s, transportation professionals have predominantly focused on raising levels of service for motor vehicle users by widening roads. The Texas Transportation Institute studied 70 metropolitan areas over 15 years and found that the conventional strategy of expanding roads has had virtually no impact on congestion. The Institute confirmed that metropolitan areas that spent heavily on increasing motor vehicle carrying capacity were no less congested than those that spent nothing on widenings. Though counterintuitive to many, our profession's long-standing popular assumption that widening roads eases congestion is false. However, over the decades, the unsuccessful battle with congestion has directly and indirectly resulted in harm to others in a number of ways. Arguably, pedestrians, the litmus test for good cities, have suffered the most due to our past motor vehicle focus, sprawling cities, poor pedestrian facilities, and hostile street environments. Through 2020 hindsight, our profession now realizes that a century ago, American cities were as pedestrian-friendly and as transit-friendly as European cities. But through a series of deliberate choices, we retrofitted and expanded our cities in a highly motor vehicle-oriented way. Many cities are so poorly designed now that motor vehicles have effectively become prosthetics, without which people could simply not function effectively. Expansive highways built through rural and natural lands opened up vast areas for developers. Beautiful meadows and forests were covered with tract housing and strip development. Farms, along with some of our most fertile lands and ecosystems, were lost. Sprawl, the unintended but real consequence of our transportation system, happened. Congestion was unfortunately equated with failure by our profession, and despite colossal public funding and effort over the last 50 years to beat congestion, the conventional transportation strategies proved less than ineffective. The more motor vehicle capacity that was built, the bigger the problem became. With half a century of experience, the profession's epiphany was that it was not the roads that were really failing, but the conventional transportation paradigm. In a nutshell, the inputs into the conventional model were levels of service for motorists and forecasts of even more congestion unless the roads were widened. The models were simplistic facsimiles of reality, presuming all else being equal. However, all else was not equal, and people began driving further than they had ever driven before, more than doubling their vehicle miles traveled per capita in a mere 35 years between the years of 1960 and 1995. As areas became more motor vehicle oriented, pedestrian and bicycle travel became less safe and less popular. As a result, people increasingly replaced pedestrian and bicycle trips with motor vehicle trips, exacerbating the problems. New motor vehicle-dependent development patterns were spawned. Low-density tract housing, big-box retail, and warehouse schools became common land uses that responded to the large scale of the road-building efforts. Public transit was simply not feasible in these types of areas due to the low concentrations of people and the long travel distances. The conventional antidote of road widening could not keep up to sprawl due to limited space, money, and public support. Furthermore, the deteriorating road infrastructure from early road building boom times needed professional attention and increasing scarce government funding for repairs. climates in cities were affected by our development patterns and asphalt expanses, raising the city temperatures in the summer months due to what are known as heat island effects. Heat, tailpipe emissions, and other pollutants contributed to smog, which became a serious health issue, reducing the quality of life for people, and occasionally killing them, as happened to this freezer truck full of people and about 700 others in Chicago's 1995 heat wave. Our motor vehicle dependency and resulting development patterns have contributed greatly to a countrywide inactivity and obesity epidemic, according to the Center of Disease Control, in adults and children. It is a startling statistic that an average 11-year-old boy today is 11 pounds heavier than an average 11-year-old boy in 1973. Consequently, diabetes has grown to become a huge problem in adults and children, along with a host of other lifestyle and environmental diseases, including various cancers, asthma, heart disease, and depression. Children born after the year 2000 have a shorter life expectancy than their parents due to lifestyle and environmental diseases overtaking the ability of our medical industry to counter them. To add fuel to the fire, most credible sources predict that the world demand for oil will outpace the ability to extract and refine oil within about 10 years. In the meantime, we have built cities with the most highly inefficient transportation and land use patterns in the history of the world in terms of energy and land consumption per capita. Left unaddressed, it will not take long for economic problems associated with this wastefulness to weaken us internationally. The cumulative effects of deforestation, CO2 emissions, and generally messing with natural systems is contributing to global problems. Melting ice caps, rising ocean levels, expanding deserts, droughts, and extreme weather events may be Mother Nature's way of giving us a hint that it's time to change our ways. So let's talk about context-sensitive solutions. Context-sensitive solutions are an integral part of smart growth. Context-sensitive solutions include context-sensitive design, in which projects are designed to suit their context, but they also include solutions that do not require anything to be designed at all. For example, changing policies to require street trees or mixed-use zoning requires no design. Context-sensitive solutions involve working with the community, working within the various levels of context, ranging from the general need to reduce motor vehicle dependency to the specific context of the location, and applying the principles of smart growth. We will review some of the most important aspects of context-sensitive solutions, starting with approaching context-sensitive solutions with objectivity. We need to recognize some of our own profession's historic biases and fix them. For example, the Highway Capacity Manual, though sold as a technical document, contains language and value sets that are inherently biased to be pro-motor vehicle. This should come as no surprise due to its inception during the golden age of the motor vehicle. For example, the common use of the word improvement when discussing a street project is biased in favor of the beneficiaries of the project against those and that which is harmed. In this case, the widening project benefits motorists while harming the urban forest, the residents, and residential property values. The use of such value-based words indicates a bias, intentionally or not, by the user, and results in a lowering of credibility with an objective audience. Perfectly accurate and objective substitutes exist and need to be used. Similarly, the idea that changing the type of street from a collector street to an arterial street is an upgrade indicates a bias. Audiences that share the bias might not notice. However, an audience that is looking for a different outcome would perceive the bias. Critics may scoff at this as being just politically correct. However, if a speaker or writer wants to be and appear to be an objective professional, then he or she simply needs to avoid biased language. Efficient is a highly misused word when involved with widening strategies. Motor vehicle carrying capacities may have increased increased and congestion has remained unchanged. The concept of speed is key to context-sensitive solutions. The first idea is to recognize the plain physics involved with speed, that the effects of different speeds are not proportional to the speed. For example, a driver going 20 miles per hour has a stopping sight distance of about 150 feet, but the stopping sight distance at 40 miles per hour is not simply double. It's actually about 600 feet. Similar non-linear relationships are involved with other phenomena. For example, the likelihood of a pedestrian dying in a collision with a car increases dramatically with speed. Some drivers drive faster than the street's design speed. Consequently, the effects of different design speeds on non-motorists, such as shop owners and pedestrians, is more than the nominal change in design speed. A change of 30 miles per hour to 40 miles per hour in design speed would be perceived as more like the difference between 35 miles per hour and 45 miles per hour design speed, which is much more impactful due to the nonlinear effects of rising speeds. Oppositely, changes in design speeds from 40 miles per hour to 30 miles per hour or 30 miles per hour to 20 miles per hour results in much better environments for non-motorists. The second idea about speed has to do with context. Conventionally, design speeds were the lowest on local streets, higher on collector streets, higher on arterial streets, and highest on highways. In a context-sensitive solutions environment, the functional classification does not dictate design speed. Instead, design speed is a function of the context. For example, it is okay to have design speeds of 50 miles per hour on a highway outside of town, but in town, design speeds of 25 miles per hour are appropriate. Just outside each end of town, there is a transition area for changing from the high rural design speeds to the town's low design speeds. 100 years ago and earlier, local, collector, and arterial streets operated at the same speeds, the speed of a walking horse. As a result, even the busiest streets had retail fronting them, residential uses alongside, pedestrian traffic, and transit. It was a very modern and incorrect idea that big streets in cities also had to be fast streets. It was mainly the negative effects of high motor vehicle speeds in cities that caused retail uses, residential uses, and pedestrians to gravitate away from the big streets. Consequently, for our urban areas to be successful, it is important to employ lower design speeds. There are two types of safety from a design perspective. The first type is conventional design safety, where we provide clear zones, forgiving bridge abutments, etc., so that when drivers leave the road, collide with other objects, or otherwise lose control of their motor vehicles, the least harm comes to them and their passengers. The second and newer type is behavioral design safety, where we design the street to result in safe driver behavior, lower speeds, and fewer collisions. Behavioral design safety is typically included as part of context-sensitive design projects in urban areas. Some people know it as traffic calming. Our ideas about design safety have changed over the years, outside and inside of cars. Consider seatbelts, for example.
That's a long slideshow. I'm not going to show the rest of it. I can get DVD copies. I think several of you have gotten copies of the DVD, if anybody else wants copies of them. This discussion of behavioral design indicates a vast change in the way the profession is starting to approach designing streets. And it is occasioned by the fact that there's a lot more information available now. We have 40 years of history with the interstate highway system. We've seen what's happened when we tried to apply design standards that were built around moving as many cars as rapidly and as efficiently over larger distances as possible and apply those same design standards to urban streets, and it hasn't worked. typically the wide, flat, fast approach to urban collector streets and even urban arterials has not led to improved mobility, and it has had negative impacts on the livability of the neighborhoods and streets, the safety of kids going back and forth to school. I talked to the state's got a Safe Routes to Schools coordinator now, Steve Songson, and his latest statistics show that nationally, 22% of the trips on our national highways are school-related. And this has to do with an overall problem that has occurred, and the transportation planning has been taking place in isolation from land use planning, and there's been inadequate coordination with other institutions and other professions and other disciplines. School districts plans get school locations based on frequently the cheapest land they can buy, which means that they may be busing students over longer distances, which precludes them from walking to school anymore. 20-some years ago, 80% of kids walked to school in the elementary and high school grades. Now, fewer than 20% do. So we've had a vast change, and a lot of it has had to do with the type of transportation networks we're designing. The largest study ever done on highway safety, it was done by Robert Noland, who is a transportation consultant to both the aviation and terrestrial transportation industry. He's a professor at London Imperial College in their transportation studies. He compiled data from all 50 states over 14 years because the profession had been saying we're obviously building safer roads because the number of accidents, deaths have been going down steadily over the last 40 years. When Noland looked at the study, he said, okay, but your model didn't include changes in automobile design, changes in emergency medical services, changes in demographics, changes such as seatbelt laws, drunk driving laws, etc. When he put all of these factors into his model, the result, the one conclusion that he came from, was that the ever-widening streets, both lane width and numbers of lanes, but primarily lane width, had actually contributed that the infrastructure itself was less safe. Because, and that conclusion, subsequent studies have implied, comes because this permissive, forgiving design really results in inattentive drivers. Drivers react to what is designed. I don't know if you've all had the occasion to drive. I have in the deserts of Nevada. It's pretty hard to keep a car under 80 miles an hour, and frequently you can hit 100 without really knowing it because there's no perception of movement. You've got this vast flat space with no vertical friction whatsoever. So his conclusion was that as lane widths approach 12 feet and more in some divisions, it actually has resulted in more and more severe accidents. The ideas that were developed in freeway design, one of which is obviously sight distance is important, so the longer, further ahead you can see, the more time you have to react, works well on a freeway. But if you, what happens in an urban street environment or just a normal surface street environment, when you have a long sight distance, you simply, if you take a hill out because it improves the sight distance, drivers are not static in it. Statistically, they will simply increase their speeds because they feel safe when they can see that distance. So the result of a lot of the things that we thought of as being safe designs, the nominal safety he was talking about that comes out of the Green Book and other manuals, actually contributed to streets that were less safe, to cars going faster where you don't want them to go fast, with commensurate, more serious accidents, a car going 15 miles an hour, 20 miles an hour, has an accident with a pedestrian, 85% of the pedestrians are going to survive. A car going 40 miles an hour has an accident with a pedestrian, 85% of the pedestrians are going to die. Those are the current statistics. And if you look at their quality of life over a longer period of time, the 15% that don't die in the higher speed accidents frequently wish they had because they have seriously impaired. So, at least in terms of the urban street design, which is where we started looking at CSS, there are many, many lessons that are being learned. There are lots of statistics that need to be incorporated in the formal adoption of CSS, which says street design requires multidisciplinary input, not just an engineer, but you need to look at the financial impacts, the impacts on surrounding properties, historical archaeological, other things. It says you have to have the human factors folks involved in the design. Does this make sense? You really have to start the process by saying, what's our goal here? Because a lot of things that we see in this area of reduced financial capabilities, a lot of processes just seem to happen because they've always happened, not because they're really needed. So CSS starts really what should have been the thing all along. You look at what is the goal of the project. So you establish the goal. If there's been a real safety area where there was a high degree of accidents, you're looking at how do we solve this problem. If it's lack of access for kids to get to school, you look at how you solve that problem. So really defining the issues and what you're trying to accomplish. We unfortunately in this country have a history of having an engine that provided lots and lots of money for many, many years to try to solve all of our problems with pavement. That era is over. I talked to the fellow in charge of capital planning for the state. I think he's in charge of it anyway, Jeff Otteson. He said this year they don't have enough money. If they took all of their federal funds, they wouldn't have enough money just to do the deferred maintenance on the National Highway Road System, the pathetic number of miles that we have in the state now. So we need to change. This is one way of introducing change, because at either an executive order level or a statutory level from the legislature, it will require all of the state agencies to start cooperate in a process of extracting the most value out of the few dollars we have for our roads and make sure we get the best bang for the buck. I have an ongoing debate with Mark Needhold, who's head of design. Mark believes in CSS, CSD, but he thinks DOT should just implement it themselves. Well, they can implement, they can control their employees, but that doesn't mean that they're going to get the time they need from public safety or from Department of Environmental Conservation or other agencies. Here in Anchorage, we're lucky we have in the police department Nancy Reeder, who's head of traffic control unit, spends an inordinate amount of time participating in discussions like this, is an avid fan of CSS, is an avid fan of roundabouts, understands what the impacts of poor design are, because she has to deal with both picking up the pieces and parts of people after the accidents and trying to enforce speed limits that don't make any sense in terms of the design. If you design a road that looks like it's built to drive 60 miles an hour, quite a few people are going to go that fast. If it looks like it's designed to go 80 miles an hour and they feel comfortable, they're going to go that fast. So part of CSS is designing the scale of the street to get the desired behavior. That's the behavioral design that Jack Lettier was talking about. We're still in transition, but the legislative approach or the executive order approach will get us where we need to be faster. We're going to get there eventually, but we can speed up the process and probably save some money and save some lives, or at least get better value from the money we're spending if we do it now. So I've been talking to Bob for a couple of years about it. Last year we did some presentation to the Senate Transportation Committee. We're hoping that this next year that either legislation or an executive order will implement it. And I think there's some people here from Jim Lamson came in from the municipality, who I believe has started a CSS program. Is that correct, Jim?
Yeah, we need to somebody recording, so we just can't have free conversation. So it sounds like you're about wrapped up. Is there any questions from Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Frank, are there places that use this this planning process now?
Yes. Actually, CSS is the number two strategic goal of the Federal Highway Administration, to have 50 state implementation by the end of this year. So it's a top strategic goal of the Federal Highway Administration. The program started, I think, in 1998 at a national symposium called Thinking Beyond the Pavement. And it started with five states implementing programs that have come to be called context-sensitive solutions. It's spread to now, I think there are 25 or so states that have either statutory or executive order implementation. There's some form of CSS officially implemented either at the policy level or some program level in almost all of the states now. Anchorage, AMATS, at least, has nominally adopted CSS. They have not done much yet in terms of implementation. I think Jim can kind of tell us what the status is on that. And DOT tells me that they're using, I think Dave Post used some of the CSS techniques on the freeway-to-freeway connection design here in working with the community. So there's some penetration, but it's still fairly slow in Alaska, but it's very broad outside. AASHTO had a national convention last fall, which is setting up a bunch of other training programs for state DOTs and others to try to accelerate the process of adoption.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Is there enough of a track record to be able to document what the effect of using this is on planning costs and project costs?
Yes. I think there is enough for any reasonable person to say, A, it probably costs no more, and it frequently can save money. One of the instances, if you look on the web under CSS, the top three sites, one is done by the Federal Highway Administration, one is done under contract to the Federal Highway and AASHTO by the Project for Public Spaces. One of the classic examples they use of how CSS can really make a difference was on US 93, which was a project in, I think, Montana, going north into the northern states, Montana and Wyoming. And it had embroiled in controversy for about 23 years. It was going through a variety of different terrains. It was going through some native lands that had historical and archaeological significance. It was going through recreational stuff, and it had been embroiled in process. They backed up, threw everything off the table, brought in a team that had been trained in CSS, and actually got all of the various interest groups to the table and came in and got it built. So effectively, they took something that had been installed and they spent millions and millions of dollars on trying to battle to some resolution, pulled it off the table. And that has been the kind of information that I've gotten anecdotally. Let's face it, we've been talking. Some of this stuff has been part of the profession for many years, and some practitioners have done it better than others. The states where we've seen the most success have said, A, it costs no more, it saves controversy, and it breaks this design, what the profession calls a design, defend, redesign, and, you know, this loop that you get into with a project if it's not acceptable to the community or some action group. So I would say ultimately it saves you money and it builds, restores the credibility. Right now there's a great deal of friction, I think, between the public and some of the professional institutions based on, when I first started going to public hearings here in town, the answer to every question was, well, it's a federal standard. Well, it takes about 20 minutes of research to realize that there aren't any federal standards here. You've got guidelines, and you're relying on professional training to come up with the best answer, and that if it's defensible and if it's reasonable and there aren't any legal issues with the traffic calming or CSS. But we had gotten lazy here, and it was difficult to deal with the public, so the answer was always, oh, that's the standard. It has to be that way. And the municipality did it, too. Now, I think because of the demand for CSS, you're seeing much more comprehensive discussions on the financial front, on the safety issues, on the impacts on both individuals and property values and overall livability of community. So by and large, my assessment is, A, it will cost no more. You know, I think you'll find that verified in the reading you want to do. It will actually improve process. You'll get more roads built at the end of the day with less controversy and with a higher degree of satisfaction when they're done.
Okay. Let's try and refrain from calling the DOT people lazy while they're in the room. Representative Dugan, is that Booth?
Sorry, I wasn't actually trying to start a fight here, Mr. Chairman. I'd just be interested in seeing some statistics. It seems to me counterintuitive that you're going to involve more people in a planning process, that it's not going to take longer and cost more. I'm perfectly willing to look at what the actual facts are, the experiences.
Right.
And it also strikes me that this may be a system that might work better on bigger, more controversial projects and not quite so well on projects where you're simply trying to,
get people from point A to point B in your town, you know, without destroying their shock absorbers or, you know, in cases like that. But I'd be happy to see some actual statistical information on this.
We've got quite a few DOT people here that are going to come up next. Representative Book?
To that point, I'd like to work with Frank, and I'd like to, in the next couple months, get some data, get some information, get some hard statistics here. It's going to be the same question. They're going to be more difficult when we get into the legislature next year. They're going to want to know cost. They're going to want to see proof. They're going to want to see where this has been implemented, and especially if we can establish some sort of history, then you and I, Frank, will go into this with a much better probability of having these issues promoted. So I will commit myself to doing that with you.
Well, I'll send the Dunbar papers that I sent to you. There is a lot of statistical stuff out there, Representative Dugan, including the Nolan Research, Eric Dunbar, Texas Transportation Institute has got probably the most voluminous data sets on how effective or ineffective our current programs have been. And I'd be happy to send those to you, or maybe the
You can send it to my office, and we'll send it out to the members. So,
thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming down, Frank. We've got, first of all, Jennifer Witt. And who do you represent?
The Alaska Department of Transportation.
Oh, okay.
And with me today is Tom Doherty, who is one of our construction group chiefs. I am the regional planning manager for Central Region here in DOT. And Tom has worked very closely with the community and various stakeholders on some of our design build projects, including the Parks Glen interchange, and then the one that's going on right now is the Glen Braga interchange. And so what I would like to do today is to frame the discussion a little bit, first based on the definition of context-sensitive solutions that's offered by FHWA. I want to frame, again, the discussion in terms of planning, and that's where I come in, and using AMATS and Anchorage as an example, talk about the recent efforts and the level of stakeholder outreach that was done during that process. And then I think it's really important to understand, as Representative Dugan mentioned, the challenges that we face as a community and as a department in implementing and doing some of the things that are that Mr. McCreary has talked about.
And Jennifer, before you start, we've got 8 DOT people. Are you basically?
No, there's just the two of us testifying today.
It's just the two of you.
Then we're going to cite some examples of things that have worked well in neighborhoods, and then I'll turn it over to Tom, and he can discuss some of the processes that we have gone through and highlight some successful applications. What is CSS? Everybody should have a copy of the handout that has the definition straight out of the reference to FHWA's definition that's within a website specifically dedicated to context-sensitive solutions. It is a collaborative, I'd like to read it for the record, a collaborative interdisciplinary approach that involves all stakeholders to develop a transportation facility that fits its physical setting and preserves scenic, aesthetic, historic, and environmental resources while maintaining safety and mobility, and I want to emphasize that, maintaining and not at the expense of safety and mobility. CSS is an approach that considers the total context within which a transportation improvement project will exist. Something that, from my perspective within the department, is that it is not synonymous with traffic calming, nor is it synonymous with a design by popular vote. And we have some examples here where it shows that, indeed, often it is not the cheapest option. But that doesn't mean it doesn't get implemented. The next handout I'd like to bring your attention to is the description of the Anchorage Bowl 2025 Long Range Transportation Plan that was featured by the Federal Highway Administration as a case study in the successful application of context-sensitive solutions on the transportation planning front. And it focuses primarily on the process and the involvement of specific stakeholders in getting community, basically consensus, on developing a highway-to-highway connection. This is a documenting, too, for the record, for as the project moves into development, the expectations and the needs and the values of the community that it impacts. Those who have been here for a long time can may be able to remember when the Glen Highway was widened to four lanes and brought right through Mountain View into the heart of downtown, as well as I and L Street.
Actually, at least one of us is old enough.
Okay. I was going to be complimentary here. As well as Ingram and Gamble. I mean, those are two major connections through town, actually were built directly through neighborhoods. And this last long-range transportation plan recognized that, as well as looking at all of the data, the safety data. It's no surprise that our most congested locations are also the locations with the highest number of accidents and severity of fatalities, severity of accidents, as well as the locations where the neighborhoods are really pursuing traffic calming, such as in Fairview and in Mountain View. So that's no accident. So all of these things really focused on the need to get to a way to preserve the neighborhoods, reconnect them, as well as provide for the transportation and the movement needs within the community and get them out of the neighborhoods. And so this is just a summary of that, and actually we are moving forward with this expectation for development for a cut and cover, basically a depressed facility to connect Fairview over the top. And Tom will address a little bit the process that he's gone through with the very first phase of this highway-to-highway connection being the Glen-Brookline interchange. You had asked about, Representative Dugan, the challenges that we have, and it seems counterintuitive that people would get very involved at the planning stage, and that is absolutely correct. And anybody here that's working transportation planning knows how hard it is to generate that level of interest. And this chart, the first one in the stapled handout, shows the amount, it's the bisecting lines of increasing public interest as you get out of the planning through the programming and actually into construction. Some people really don't take notice or want to participate until they see the bulldozers out there during construction. And yet their ability to influence those decisions commensurately decrease over time as we get closer. So how that is the challenge, how to motivate the public to get involved early on in project development. Another challenge that we are faced with in this profession is the fact that projects take a long time to reach construction. And this problem is exacerbated in Alaska when we have a 20-year, 25-year history of relying pretty much exclusively on the federal highway process for project delivery. We're starting to see a little bit of a difference now, and Tom can talk about it too, the dynamics you have in involving and keeping the interest of stakeholders from project inception to project delivery, and that's something we can talk about with this design build project on the interchange. But this chart demonstrates the linear format of a federal highway project. And once oil had taken a dip in the 80s, we turned exclusively to the federal highway program. We are the only state that does that. And so, and it does have a very linear process, in that I can tell you right now that if we had used federal highway funds on the Glen-Brookline interchange, we would still be doing an environmental impact statement. Same with the Abbott Loop Road extension. And so using other funding sources allows a lot more compressed time frame. But this is one of the challenges we have. How do you generate and maintain that interest over time when you have a turnover in neighborhoods and populations and things like that? The other challenge we have, and I'd like to bring your attention to the bar charts on this page here, is the lack of a good and well-defined road hierarchy. A lot of the examples that Mr. McCreary had referred to were the needs within neighborhoods and on collector streets. The challenge we have is that our major arterials and our local roads over time have been forced to serve both functions. Ideally, Tudor Road, Muldoon Road would have been developed with very, very limited access and consequently not be having to serve the through movement around town, as well as providing direct access to the commercial businesses, as well as the several homes that are located immediately adjacent to the road. With that comes problems, and we've been able to get away with that for a very long time, but it's as we've grown as a community, the Mattoon Borough is experiencing this as well, where you start experiencing a high level of accidents, and as the congestion increases and the conflicts increase. So that is one of the challenges here, and we may refer back to this chart. Another challenge, and I think this is one that has become very relevant on some roads here, within Anchorage, is improving existing roads that do indeed function as collectors. Unfortunately, these roads are oftentimes originally developed in older neighborhoods where homes immediately access the roads. I used some examples from Eagle River. That's where I got the pictures this morning. A couple of them. Baranoff Street was developed as a dirt road to provide access to a school, and as the municipality came in and paved it and provided pedestrian amenity, you know, provided a sidewalk and lighting for the school. Meadow Creek Drive is one that was developed initially as a dead-end road, but it was extended farther, connects to another arterial, and needed to be retrofitted because it was not only a school bus route, but also a people mover route. And so and this is one where the municipality came in and shoehorned in basically a sidewalk that is heavily used now. Business Boulevard in Eagle River was one that was developed in a commercial district. And at the time of development, the landowners were not required to put in sidewalks. And so it was a very, very expensive retrofit that accommodates a attached sidewalk on one side, separated trail on the other. So the challenge and the biggest application of some of the context-sensitive solutions that are gaining ground right now are on these types of facilities. The collector roads is where there's a lot of attention. And again, in Anchorage, we're doing much better on developing our collector street system with the problems we have in the Mattoon Borough are that we lack collector streets and that our arterials are starting to be congested with high levels of accidents. I had missed one of the pages here. The black and white one is talking a little bit about what are some of the techniques that have been bandied about, what are some of the things that work. There's been a lot of work done in the Fairview neighborhood. These are actually traffic calming techniques that are appropriate for neighborhoods but are not appropriate for the facilities. We do need to have roads that and protect facilities whose main purpose is to get people from point A to point B without providing access to the lands immediately adjacent. There's the Fairview has it all. They have the diverters where basically it used to be a wide road and they have problems with cut-through traffic, speeding, crime. And so now to get through Fairview is a little bit of a trick. Diverters is where you totally cut off the access but provide pedestrian movement through there. The bulb outs, the curb bulb outs, certainly help decrease the distance between for the pedestrians crossing the road, and it also gives some visual, the horizontal visual and vertical effect that Mr. McMurray had referred to. Entryway signs into a neighborhood is done there. The next one was actually taken in the Turnagain area where the city has done raised intersections and speed bumps as a way of traffic calming, you know, getting people to slow down within the neighborhoods. And the other thing is the chicane, or basically a curve developed into a road specifically to help slow traffic and to notify the driver that they are in a different place. And that, again, is in Fairview. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Tom Doherty and talk about some of the projects we've done and who have been some of the stakeholders that we've had to work with that were critical to project implementation success. And with that?
Yeah, essentially, I'm Tom Doherty, and essentially, most of my time is spent on the back end of it where we get the people calling up saying we're disrupting their neighborhoods and what the heck do you think you're doing. But I've also been involved with three of our, I guess, higher profile projects. Again, I have to agree with Frank on a couple of things. I don't think it would cost anything more. And I don't, I guess, my opinion is it's not done across the board, but I'd like to at least submit that on the projects that I'm showing you here, we follow the CSS guidelines. And you can say it doesn't cost more or it costs the same. That the situation always, and you probably are very aware of this, is cost versus time. It may take more time, and then in that case, it may cost more, but then it may save you money too. So I think it's a case-by-case basis on how you define cost and how much time it takes to develop it. When we're talking about getting all the stakeholders together, for us on our major highways, our stakeholders are a lot different than they are in an urban environment. You take a look at the Glen Parks interchange. We pushed that that freeway through that wetland area back in the early or mid-60s, and a lot of resource agencies were basically waiting to get another bite at us when we came back through again. And it was a bit of a challenge, and from about a year and a half, we met every 2 weeks with all the stakeholders. There's a fish and game, there's the DNR, there's fish and wildlife, there was the native group in Eklutna. There's a whole bunch of different stakeholders that wanted to see this done differently the next time, and basically we got them all together and we had them on board from the beginning. And this job went fairly well, even to the end where the contractor, it was a design-build type situation, the contractor came up with an innovative solution himself, which saved us about another 7 acres of wetland involvement on that project. So I think that one, taking everything into account and starting from beginning to end, my understanding, I've had nothing but good reviews on how that project turned out. And another one of the big stakeholders on that job was the traveling public, and we did a lot to try to accommodate the traveling public during the construction as well as when it was all done. There's, I would say, 99% of the people I've talked to are happy with it. There's one group out there that aren't quite happy. It's the people that travel from Wasilla to Palmer. There's a stop sign that, put a lot of interchange in out there, but there's a stop sign still. We incorporated things like the local artistry on the, I get nothing but rave reviews about that, and again, that was something we planned into it from the beginning, added very little cost to the project. It's a lot of public goodwill out of that. The next one, this is the proposed Glen Braga interchange. I first met Frank, I don't know if you remember, but I was at the Clark Middle School. It was a discussion of the whole neighborhood. Everybody come and discuss what they were going to do for their town center there and everything else. And we were presenting different ideas on the public to try to vote on how to go ahead and put this interchange in the middle of the, or to connect the two neighborhoods. And I think that process went well. We identified who we thought the affected stakeholders were early. The fire department, the police department, the middle school there, the businesses, the two neighborhoods. We identified that this is one of the highest pedestrian neighborhoods over there in the Russian Jack area, so pedestrian access throughout was very important. And I think we came up with a pretty good solution to this where, from the DOT's aspect, we still have our freeway that, we wanted to keep our freeway standards going there, but we're pretty much open to a lot of different ideas for the Braga route and things that could be done along the Braga route. Again, this was a design build, so we got innovation right at the end again, and it really is, there's a loop ramp in the north east corner there that even enhances the pedestrian walkway along there because there's no conflict with a ramp and pedestrians in the north west corner, which is also the middle school area. So I think that has worked out real well. From our standpoint, we have a tunnel coming in. If you look on the south side, there's a tunnel that goes from the Russian Jack community underneath the road and then winds up and over to Clark. We identified early on the locals there were really not looking forward to having a tunnel in their community, so we decided we needed to go extra wide, extra high, more lights than usual because it's just a lot of problems they've had in that neighborhood. So short of 24-hour enforcement, we had to have something that we thought was going to be very inviting and not look like a cave to go into. Oh, and then the other one was the Red Apple Market up across from the middle school. We've done extensive talking with the owner there. We're helping him with mailers during the project. When he sends out his advertising mailers, we'll send out a clip-on with that that tells him where the what the construction will be doing during the next month and the best way for his customers to get there. He was very happy with the way we, so far, have approached it and how he can keep his business going while there'll be impact. But I think we've come up with a pretty good plan here where there is very limited impact to what the traveling public will see, and the neighborhood will still be able to, they'll be able to get across a lot better. One thing that worked out nice for us here is also the Clark Middle School bond passed, and it would be nice that we don't have middle school people in the middle of our construction during what's going on. And here's some of our back here. We got awards for some of these jobs from FHWA, and it was for our way that we did take CSS into our process. So I guess the upshot of this is I agree with Mr. Neidhold that on many of our projects, we are embracing the CSS method of developing these projects. And again, I think it's the way to go. You need to start out with it because you don't want to go and get to 90% and have someone come in from the side and blow up the project. So it is it's the way you need to go about doing these things without having surprises at the last minute.
You did a better job of in favor of CSS than I did probably. People will show up at the 95%. That's when they find out about it. So you're saying using the CSS techniques has worked and made it the project to work smoother for you? And
I think that's a good synopsis. We're not. I don't think the DOT is against CSS. That's not what we're trying to say here. I think it's a successful way to develop a project.
Folks, we need to keep it a little tight. For the record, they don't know who's talking. So when they type it, they have no idea who's conversing. So if we could just keep it through the chair, that would be much more appreciated for the record. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The cost question has got sort of two elements. One is how this process would affect the project planning cost, and the second is how it would affect the actual project cost. So has your experience been that this planning method results in changes in design that increase the cost of the project?
My experience would say no, it doesn't. Because you're not changing the design, you're designing what you've taken the information from the stakeholders, and from there you don't just say, okay, we'll do everything, but you need to make a reasoned decision on which way to go forward. And as long as you have input from the stakeholders, then you're going ahead and not going ahead to 90% and then having to stop and start again. So,
thank you, Mr. Doherty. Representative Dugan,
thanks to continue that. That's the second time you've used that example.
Excuse me.
That going to 90% and then having to stop and start all over again. Is it the department's experience that before it was using this process, it had a lot of those kinds of situations?
This is Tom Doherty again. No, I wouldn't say there's a lot of them, but there are, you know, it only takes one that you don't want to see that happen again.
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, going back to the chart that talked about projects taking a long time, the successes that Tom is citing are those under the red bars, basically where we were not following the linear process of a federal aid project, but within 2 to 3 years working with the same group to get from inception to actual construction, and that is very, very rare. The problems we have when we get to 90-95% design is when we have a protracted and very long development process because of the type of environmental document required or because of the lack of funding and the inability to move forward with a federal aid project very smoothly. And that is very, as an example, the C Street extension that has just been completed is one that when I came on with DOT almost 20 years ago was being planned and had been planned for many years but had been proposed and design had been with hits and starts. So it's taken 20 years, my entire career, to see the project built. That is the type of project that is very difficult to do in with keeping the momentum up with effective stakeholder involvement when it takes so long. And when you have a changeover in who lives out there, what the development patterns have been, what the impacts will consequently be. But it's also one that now that it's complete, it's functioning actually very well as intended as more of an expressway type facility, meaning few driveways, limited breaks every quarter of a mile. But that is a big thing, and the success with the CSX examples that Tom has cited has been with a non-federal aid project.
Anything else? Just one more thing. The description that Tom gave about stakeholders was a list of state and federal agencies. So this is a process that's necessary to keep the bureaucrats from stopping projects going forward primarily. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, this is Tom Doherty again. In my experience, it's very important to bring the resource agencies in early.
And through the chair, Representative Dugan, building on that, it depends on the type of the project as well. The primary stakeholders in the Parks Glen interchange were the resource agencies. And they were it was key to have them, again, involved from the get-go. That one was funded with a congressional earmark. It was able to move forward very, very quickly and done as design build, but they were able to get even more creative with the design. So.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything? Yes, sir. Okay. We're going to move on. We've got a couple more folks. Jim Lamson from Anchorage, Municipality of Anchorge. Did you want to add anything to the conversation? What are you guys up to? Or what's your opinion of this deal?
Well, context-sensitive solution and sensitive design means different things to different people. I think from the municipality's standpoint, what we've seen as the greatest value in it is when you bring it, everybody wants to build the right project. But what the right project is varies with the perspective and values of different people. And we have already been, for probably 2 or 3 years, trying to identify and bring a broader base of stakeholders in early on in the planning stage. It does take longer in the planning stage. But if you are able to identify the stakeholders and bring the issues out on the table so that you've got all the concerns and issues right there to evaluate at the very beginning, it seems like the time, extra time and extra money that it takes gets the designers where they can go quicker, where it's less time and less money there. Sometimes the projects do cost more. Sometimes they cost less, depending on what the solution comes out of it. I was just thinking through different projects that we've worked on with the municipality. Most of them have been collectors, and we've developed in the last 4 or 5 years probably 8 or 9, 10 different collector street upgrades, and most of them have worked very, very well with the community, but there have been a couple of that have been a bit more of a challenge. Anybody heard of Strawberry Road? Okay. And 35th and McRae has been the latest one that has taken an awful lot of time. But in conclusion, I think the idea of bringing more people to the table earlier, bringing a broader disciplinary approach in viewing what the needs are, really is helpful in building, coming up with a better project in the end.
Okay. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we've got people from all of the agencies that may be involved in this, so I'd like to ask a couple of questions about a couple of projects in my district that haven't worked out quite so well as at least the people who think that this is the method to use would have liked. And those are specifically the changes that have been made and are being made in Arc Boulevard, and the ones that were at least contemplated on Fireweed Lane, which has got essentially every it's Spinard Road. I'm never quite sure where they're talking about that. Every business owner in my district is up in arms about that. So I guess I'd start by saying, was this the method that was used to design
any or all of those projects. And I think that this part, in part is DOT and in part is municipalities. Isn't that correct?
This is Tom Doherty. Isn't the municipality developing all three of those? Didn't they develop all three of those?
Well, I've been involved just a little with all three. This is Jim Lamson. The Fireweed project, the majority of it, state facility. And several years ago, the state worked at developing something, and it ended up being tabled, and then it was reintroduced, and then somehow another, the municipality won the lottery to pursue that through the public involvement and design process. And it got very involved in the context-sensitive solutions or public involvement approach. And I have not been involved in the details, but that one seems to be been real problematic in finding consensus. Is that a good?
That's as diplomatically the situation could be described, I believe.
The goals and values different people wanted, they're very, very different. Arctic Boulevard, I think there is one that is a municipal project. The state is involved because the state manages construction on all federally funded projects. I know the community was involved a good bit at the beginning, but I'm not sure how that worked. Obviously, it could have worked better. That was another good diplomatic.
Mm-hmm.
It could have worked better. And then the third one you mentioned was Spinard Road. And one of the challenges in these processes is you get to different points, you have different groups that will show up. And some real concerned group will come up at the beginning and they'll be happy. And then they won't come anymore. And then the ones that don't like so trying to find out where the real community views are is a challenge. And I think that happened on Spinard Road. It seemed like it was moving along real, real well, and then there were some concerns raised. But context, I think if we tried to do these projects without involving stakeholders, they might get done quicker. But when you get to the final design phase, that's when everybody's going to really hit the fan.
Thank you. I guess what I'm trying to figure out here is if the problems on these projects would be lessened by using this approach, or if they've been caused by using this approach, or if, in fact, the problems are that the changes were driven by the traffic planners as opposed to the users of the street. See what I mean? I mean, sort of how you solve this problem depends on how you define it, which is one of the reasons I'm skeptical of using this as a template for every transportation project that the state has, because there are cases in which I can easily envision simply using this system is going to cause you problems that you wouldn't otherwise have. But if the problem is that involving the stakeholders in the design has stopped the design, then if there's some practical reason for changing the design, that's a problem. If it's simply a difference of opinion between the people who make primary use of the roads and the traffic planners, that's a different kind of a problem. And so I'm not sure how or if this particular system of planning projects was used here, should have been used here, or would have improved things had it been used here. And the reason I'm asking these questions is I'm trying to use something that I'm familiar with as a model here to figure out really, I mean, this all sounds good sort of in the abstract, but what happens when you actually use it on a project in which, you know, there are, you know, sort of widely varying differences of opinion about what should happen here based on sort of what your use of that particular stretch of road is.
Well, I think
what would be good was we're going to get some information from Mr. McCleary before next session. And if you guys keep this in the back of your mind, Representative Dugan's questions, we'll have a hearing in Juneau and talk about that since we'll have more information.
Yeah. Good.
So in the meantime, if you guys can get together with your questions, and you know, DOT will be ready to. So we'll spend a couple hours in Juneau with the full committee, and I don't think we're going to get the answers right now.
No, I'm just.
So if we can do that, is there anybody else in the room that wants to testify? No, Representative Book, I'm going to let you close out the meeting.
Is there anybody online?
No, we listen only online.
Okay. What I'd like to do, can we use your office as a liaison to go through for information?
Yeah, you can send
anybody that wants to have contact for any information or contact numbers or parties involved, go through Kyle Johansson's office. Right. It'll be through David Scott, probably, or
Randy.
Randy.
Juneau.
Okay, so it'll be in Juneau. And I'll be here in Anchorage. I have an office right here in this building. If you have any particular questions that you want to ask of me or whatever, I'll be available anytime. Make myself available. The most, I think, I don't know what you say. One of the reasons I'm here is because we've been dealing with one particular project for 15 years, and that is the Strawberry Road project, and it's coming to culmination. And whether or not the neighborhood is going to be satisfied with that, I think we're going to probably be seeing construction next year, 2008.
It's supposed to be this year. When's it supposed to go out?
It's already up to bid. If it hasn't already, it'll be pretty soon.
Right. So there's been a lot of involvement. There's a great deal of pros and cons from the neighbors in that area. And I was thinking of an approach in these discussions not as a model to be used as a boilerplate, but as only a tool in the toolbox that we can use specifically where it's applicable. And certainly, you know, to have some sort of a format that you people are going to use for every situation, there is none such. But I think to have open discussion, bringing people on board, in my mind, certainly there's a cost involved. But when it is the public's money, and we're looking at utilization of funding that doesn't look to me like it has been as well spent as it might well be, then we need to look at some changes. And if this is the potential for a part of a design change, then I think we all should be considerate of that thought process. And that's basically what this is. This isn't any mandate. That isn't the reason for this meeting. It's for interchange of ideas. And if in case, in a case by case, we can utilize a system or a different way of thinking, and I think that it's long overdue.
Good. Okay. Anything?
No, that's it. All right. Thank you very much.
We'll be adjourned at 2:45.